Ever since the CJEU judgments of Van Genden Loos and Costa Enel, in which the court pronounced that the EU has its own legal order, our understanding of the EU and how it operates has begun to change. On the one hand, the idea of the EU possessing its own autonomous legal order has allowed the European project to flourish. An autonomous EU legal order means that its norms draw validity from the legal order itself, and thus, as long as it exists, its norms will be binding on its member states. In other words, once issued at the EU level, norms must be respected on the national level. Thus, the EU can regulate independent of its member states' wishes. This has allowed for the development of doctrines such as direct effect, the efficacious functioning of the internal market, and a more comprehensive policy on fundamental rights. On the other hand, the idea of the EU possessing a discrete legal order has created some problems, at least from the point of view of member states. For instance, the existence of an EU legal order leads to the question whether it incorporates national legal orders or it exists alongside them. From a pluralist perspective, if member states also possess independent legal orders, then what happens when an EU norm clashes with one issued by a member state? In legal theory, the idea of clashes between EU and member state legal norms leads to further questions regarding the validity and efficacy of EU law. In terms of validity, that is, whether EU norms exist and are binding, we are confronted with the question whether EU law must necessarily be supreme to national law. And if it isn't, that is, if member states can refuse to comply with EU law, can we still say that the EU possesses a legal order? In terms of efficacy, that is, whether EU norms are in fact complied with, we have to ask ourselves whether the EU can actually claim to have a legal order if its norms are not always complied with. Some, like Justin Lindebaum, our guest speaker today, have tried to make sense of the situation. With him, we will delve into questions on the validity, efficacy, and challenges to the legal order. Hello, and welcome to the fourth episode of Integration Through Pod, a podcast by the EU Law Working Group of the European University Institute in Florence. Today we are happy to welcome Professor Justin Lindebaum from the University of Groningen, interviewed by Oscar Polanski, a researcher with the Law Department at EUI. My name is Flip Skuyen, and I'm one of your hosts. But enough from me. Enjoy the fourth episode of Integration Through Pod.
La Cour va d'abord rendre un arrêt dans l'affaire C-345 de 95, République française contre Parlement européen. La Cour déclare et arrête, premièrement.
Oscar, Justin, thank you so much for being here. The floor is yours.
All right. Well, I'm just going to repeat Flip's here. Thank you very much, Justin, for coming to the EUI, for the presentation you gave earlier today, and for agreeing to be part of this kind of interview. The questions that I have for you today are all relate to the three papers that you've written. And so just for the audience here, they are... There's a 2018 paper published in the Oxford Journal of Legal Studies, and it concerns why EU law claims supremacy. There's a 2021 paper in the European Journal of Legal Studies, and it's entitled Autonomy of EU Law, a Hartian View or a Hartian Perspective, something like that. And there's a forthcoming paper, possibly this year, maybe next year, and it's in European Papers, and it concerns federal autonomy, and it's a comparative piece comparing the autonomy of the US legal order and the EU legal order from a historical perspective. So when I refer to these papers, the 2018, 2021, 2023 papers, these are the papers that I'm referring to. So the first question is open-ended, but I feel like it's an important question to ask any theorist. What brought you to kind of consider and explore the nature of EU law, and specifically from a kind of philosophical, legal theoretical perspective?
Right, so I already become a little bit anxious when people call me a theorist, but I see where it comes from. So during my studies, both at bachelor's and master's level, I was interested both in EU law as well as in legal theory and legal philosophy. But I noticed fairly quickly that those worlds rarely touch each other. So legal philosophers like Hart, Dworkin, the big names that we discuss in any jurisprudential course, had very little to say about EU law, if anything at all. And reversely, EU lawyers, also EU constitutional lawyers or constitutional theorists, usually never refer, apart from, let's say, a cursory socially obligatory reference to the concept of law, they rarely refer or engage substantively with legal theory. And I thought that was somewhat odd. I both like those disciplines, and I thought, well, if nobody is really, well, nobody, I mean, people engage with both fields of law, of course, but comparatively speaking, few people engage in sort of the linkages between those two disciplines. I thought it would be interesting to dive into that myself.
So having studied some of your papers, I see that there's, at least to my mind, a shift in the way that you grapple with these theories. So it looked like in the 2018 paper you adhere to almost a strictly positivist approach, and you adopt RAS. You say that EU law mimics national law, that the EU legal order can be analyzed in the same way as a national legal order can be. So by reference to legal theories which were devised with national and municipal legal orders in mind. And there are many who would contest that, many who would claim that actually the EU legal order is a creature of its own and it cannot be analyzed in that way. And I'm sure you're familiar with the works of Culver and Giudice, for example, who have this argument of kind of bootstrapping, which I'm sure you, I'm certain you refer to in your paper as well. And then so you then move on to kind of Hart and trying to explain the normativity of kind of the autonomy of EU law by reference to Hart. And then in this most recent paper, you make an interesting claim in that you say that these theories or a theory of EU law doesn't even need to be positivist, which seems interesting given that the first two approaches that you have, Hart and RAS, are positivist. And so my question would be, what brought on the change? Do you think that these different approaches have different things to offer when trying to understand and explain EU law? Is it that you've come to see one of them as more correct, as a more correct way of explaining the nature of EU law? What was the reason for the change, for the shift?
Yeah, so that's a very interesting question. I'm not sure I can answer it satisfactorily. Let me start by saying that when I wrote this first paper, Why EU Law Claims Supremacy, I tried to be very careful not to make a robust claim about the nature of law in general. So I say, I think in the introduction somewhere, that I don't want to engage with the purely legal philosophical debate about positivism and non-positivism, etc., etc. Some people have argued that I fail in not engaging with the theories, and actually I do make a claim about correctness of legal theories in this regard. But what I wanted to do is to use those theories, in particular RAS and Hart as well, to better understand how the European Court of Justice specifically thinks through its jurisprudence about the EU legal order. And the reason why I sort of became interested in this is because at the time, Opinion 213 had been rendered a couple of years earlier. I was familiar with that, obviously. And I was also reading a great book called The Legal Reasoning of the European Court of Justice by José Ramón Bengocha. It's an old book. I believe it's 1993. And basically there, Bengocha makes the claim that the Court of Justice's jurisprudence should be considered or regarded as the jurisprudence of a Dworkinian court. So we can only understand the case law of the European Court of Justice by sort of looking at it from a Dworkinian perspective, in the sense that the Court of Justice is trying to create a jurisprudence of integrity. And I was reading Ben Gottschalk's work at the same time I was thinking about Opinion 213, and I was thinking, look, this Opinion 213 doesn't really make sense. It doesn't really fit into this picture of a jurisprudence of integrity. And that is how I came to think initially about Opinion 213, but then sort of the pieces of the puzzle started to get together, to fit together. I started to think about the ECJ's jurisprudence as something which can be explained from the perspective of Joseph Ross's theory of law, in which the claim to legitimate authority or the claim to supremacy plays an important role. And so that is how I sort of came to write this article, where I try to show that the court's jurisprudence, at least to an important degree, can be better understood if we see it as something that conforms to what Ross had been writing about already in the 70s. So the sort of turn that you described towards, let's say, being more open to non-positivism, I think it, in any case, it reflects a development, I think, in how I think about legal theory in general. I think that Ross, Hart, the entire strand of jurisprudence that sort of came out of that has incredibly important virtues in terms of its explanatory power. But it also has lots of problems, as you know, anyone who's been studying jurisprudence is well aware of. And I think one of the main problems there is that it has lots of difficulty understanding the internal point of view of judges who genuinely believe that they are bound by some principles or values that are not yet posited, that are not yet sort of the result of a robust social custom or social practice. And in this sense, I'm probably more agnostic right now about the sort of the correct legal theory, Hart versus Dworkin, Ross versus others. And I think both strands in jurisprudence each have weaknesses and strengths. And this applies both to them as theories of law in general and also as applied to EU law more specifically. And I think one example of this is clearly visible in debates related to constitutional pluralism and concurrent claims of supremacy by national constitutional courts and the Court of Justice, where, let's say, legal positivism, if we can use that as a sort of umbrella and rather imprecise term, has quite little to say about who's right and who is wrong, other than a sort of shallow perspectivism. And I think particular interpretivist theories of law may be more helpful in this regard in understanding these debates, perhaps adjudicating between them, but in any case, to see how these different perspectives relate to each other.
Given these multiple claims, these claims whereby national authorities and the EU disagree over what the nature of EU law is, over what the validity of EU law is, so on the one hand, you'll have national courts saying that EU law draws validity from affirmation given by the national legal order. The Court of Justice will say only that EU law is autonomous, that it is its own legal order, independent of and drawing validity from the treaties, in that sense, not being kind of, its validity not being dependent on member states. These kind of competing conceptions of what the rule of recognitions would be, I guess, are what led you to claim in, I think it was the most recent paper, that we should perhaps adopt a non-positivist theory in trying to explain the EU legal order. And you say that, and I quote, "The best jurisprudential theory of the EU legal order may need to recognize that what legal officials treat as the rule of recognition of their legal order may be different from what actually is the rule of recognition of their legal order." And so this is an interesting idea. So for those who aren't familiar, just to give you a brief recap of Hart, Hart claimed that all legal systems must possess a rule of recognition, which is a rule that determines the sources of valid law and organizes them hierarchically. So this rule of recognition comes from the practices of officials of a legal system. So we know that a legal system exists if we look at the practice of officials, and we can see that through their practice, this rule of recognition is formed. And we know this is the case because we can see this rule of recognition exists, but for the officials, they must possess something called an internal point of view regarding the rules. So they must recognize the rules of the system as their own and have a critical attitude towards the deviations from these rules. So in that sense, we would say that the EU legal order exists because the practices of national courts and the Court of Justice show us that actually there is something there, that there is that a legal system exists through their workings. But what exactly are you suggesting when you say that we've got these perceived rules of recognition, which may be different to actual rules of recognition? That seems to be a chaotic idea, to say the least, because the rule of recognition is supposed to organize sources of valid law. It's supposed to make sense of the law. And even in the UK, for example, in the Miller cases, the UK Supreme Court was kind of drawing on the rule of recognition to try to make sense on this of the complex legal situation of the UK leaving the EU. And if we now say that actually, well, some judges may be right, other judges may be wrong about what the rule of recognition is, then that would seem to introduce, I guess, maybe legal uncertainty and turmoil, chaos, which I guess isn't quite what these legal theories are supposed to do.
Yeah, so that's a great question, and I cannot really claim any credit or originality because that specific passage that you cited, I refer there to one particular interpretation of Hart's theory, which has been quite influential for my own writings. So this is an interpretation by Kevin Toe, who's a professor of legal philosophy at UCL. And as you rightly said, the mainstream interpretation of Hart's theory would suggest that the idea or the claim that the rule of recognition is different from what most legal officials think is the rule of recognition is pretty outrageous, right? It would make sense because the rule of recognition precisely is the rule that sort of is identified through observing the social practices of legal officials. And so if legal officials believe something to be the rule of recognition in a certain community, then that's what it is. Let me briefly, very briefly and too superficially outline Toe's argument. So Toe's argument, as I understand it, is that this conflation between what people believe to be the rule of recognition and what really is the rule of recognition is basically a conflation between the external and internal point of view, or the external and internal perspective on the legal order. So from an external perspective, Toe says, Hart is absolutely right that what officials treat to be some rule of recognition is, from an external perspective, the rule of recognition of a specific community. And from that, you can derive sort of the structure of the legal order that you can observe from the outside. Now, from an internal perspective, Toe argues that it cannot be the case that simply as a matter of social fact, what some officials regard to be the rule of recognition is, as such, dispositive for the normative content of the rule of recognition. So the normative content of valid legal norms within a certain system. And he makes a very, I think, persuasive argument that this is essentially at bottom a violation of the fact-norm distinction. So if you believe that norms can never arise or be derived as such from a certain factual situation, then it will be very odd to say that the normative content of law, the content of actual legal obligations that, say, legal officials have and other subjects have as well, can be derived from social fact as such. So the mere fact that some officials treat some particular rule as the rule of recognition can never be the sole reason for there being legal obligations that are binding on legal officials and laymen, ordinary folk, let's say, like us, as well. So he makes the claim that when we try to think about the rule of recognition, we need to distinguish between external formulations of the rule of recognition and internal formulations. And internal formulations, in his view, are basically claims about what should be the rule of recognition from a normative perspective. And I found this theory to be, first of all, very interesting as an interpretation of H.L.A. Hart's theory of law. But secondly, I found it to be particularly useful to think about the functioning of EU law. Because in EU law, arguably, the claims of the European Court of Justice and its jurisprudence could be regarded as being about what is the rule of recognition within the member states of the European Union, right? It makes a claim about what identifies as valid law. Now, from an external perspective, there's not much to say about that other than either the national courts accept what the court is saying or they don't. And if they do, then the rule of recognition has changed. And if they don't, then the rule of recognition has not changed and the status quo is maintained. Now, using this theory that Toe offered, I tried to make sense of the court's jurisprudence basically as laying down implicitly suggestions for a new normative formulation of a rule of recognition. So in Toe's formulation adapted to the EU, you could think of a case like Costanel or Regentenloos or any sort of landmark case of the European Court of Justice as basically saying, let's all consider R, a certain rule of recognition, to be the rule of recognition of our legal system, right? So it's an invitation, basically, a pitch, as Toe calls it, towards the national courts to rethink sort of the content and structure of legal obligations within their legal orders. Now, if you make this distinction between these normative formulations of a rule of recognition and efforts on part of some officials to convince their interlocutors that this is a better formulation of the rule of recognition, on the one hand, and on the other hand, the external observation that within a certain community, let's say Italy or France or Germany, within those communities there are officials that treat some rule of recognition as a rule of recognition, and that claim would be different from certain pitches that some officials provide to convince others of their conception of the rule of recognition. Now, of course, this is a particular, not mainstream interpretation of H.L.A. Hart's theory of law, but I think it's particularly useful if you look at all of these, let's say, judicial dialogues or judicial monologues that we have in the European Union, where I think essentially what they do is they try to convince their interlocutors, the other courts within the European judicial system, that their conception of the rule of recognition is the right one and that we should follow that one, right? But that those claims are very distinct from the external observation that some particular rule of recognition is treated as such by a certain community of legal officials.
Okay, so I guess it doesn't create as much chaos and uncertainty as I thought it did.
Well, it may create chaos, but then again, chaos in the sense of legal discussion and dialogue is probably what makes law interesting, right? So if a certain degree of what you might call chaos is precisely what makes EU constitutionalism, in my view at least, interesting as a sort of legal discipline.
Actually, this is a point that we will come back to a little later, because I do want to discuss with you the challenges that EU law is facing. And I think, at least in my opinion, one of these challenges is this discrepancy in understanding the validity of EU law. And I think this idea of competing conceptions of the rule of recognition might be one way of explaining this. So we'll come back to this, but before we go on to challenges, I'd like to engage with you or question you about efficacy. So if before we go on to challenges to EU law, let's discuss briefly the conditions for the existence of EU law. So in your 2021 paper, you argue that the autonomy of EU law is kind of intrinsically connected to its effectiveness, that there would be no EU legal order if no one applied it. And so far, I mean that makes sense. So I guess, like Kelsen, you would say that efficacy is a condition of validity, and therefore law must be efficacious. So the way that Kelsen would say, and I guess to some extent Hartman has, believe that for law to kind of exist, it must be applied by legal organs and complied with by subjects. And so at the end of the piece, you say that the degree to which EU law is judicially invocable and enforceable before a national court becomes dispositive of whether the EU legal system exists. So if I understand you correctly, please correct me if I'm wrong, you say that because national courts are EU courts, their compliance with EU law is determinative of EU law's effectiveness. So, and it being kind of a necessary condition for EU law, we know that if this condition is maintained, EU law exists. But efficacy is a complex matter, especially on the EU level, because of the fact that on the one hand, you can have the EU legal organs trying to enforce EU law, but on the other hand, the subjects still refusing to comply despite the legal organs trying to enforce it. And so for that reason, relying on kind of an efficacy, relying on efficacy as a way of explaining a legal system's or a legal order's validity or existence might be particularly problematic in the context of the EU, because while there might be an obligation, a normative duty for member states to comply with EU law, and this is being, or at least it's attempted, its enforcement is attempted by legal organs, it's not complied with by subjects. So the Polish, the decision of the Polish Constitutional Tribunal being one example. So given that kind of efficacy, given the difficulty of translating efficacy into the EU legal order, given this kind of difficulty of reconciling the enforcement of legal organs with compliance by legal subjects, is perhaps trying to gauge the existence of EU law through efficacy the right way of conceiving of its state of health? Is it perhaps more beneficial to consider the existence or the functioning of EU law in terms other than efficacy, if possible at all, given the difficulty of using the concept in making sense of EU law?
So those are extremely interesting questions. So let me offer some thoughts. So the first thought, I was triggered by your description of Kelsen and my own discussion of efficacy as a condition of validity. Now, in some sense, it's obviously right. But Kelsen makes clear that the relationship between efficacy and validity is not that efficacy as what he calls a conditio per quam for validity. So efficacy is not the reason why some norm is valid or not. It's a conditio sine qua non. So even though it's not the reason for validity, if there is no effectiveness at all, then a legal norm ceases to be valid. Now, that raises obviously the question of how much effectiveness we should have in order to maintain the validity of any legal norm or any legal system in general. I think, quite honestly, within the EU, we're far above the minimum level of effectiveness that you would need to credibly claim that the EU is an effective legal system. So these discussions obviously are also very more relevant, perhaps, in the context of public international law, where this argument of effectiveness or ineffectiveness, generally speaking, is much more powerful, at least in regard to certain parts of law, like the law of war. So in the EU, I think, obviously, you need to have a minimum level of effectiveness. That does not necessarily need to be at the national level. I think you could, in theory, have an EU legal order which operates more or less roughly like many international organizations at a international level. I would give the example of the WTO, but that's today probably a poor example because of the dysfunctioning of the adjudicatory system. But in general, I don't think anyone would deny that WTO law is a functioning legal order, even though there is no let's say, direct effect, etc., etc. I mean, Joseph Weiler makes a point now and then about the existence of primacy of EU law, and he always asks the rhetorical question, when did EU law become supreme? And then if someone says with Costa Inel, he says, you're wrong. It's only when the national constitutional courts started to accept the primacy of EU law, at least in practice. And I think he's right. So it's not impossible to conceive of an EU legal order which lacks direct effect as we know it, which lacks internal primacy as we know it. But in order to make sense of EU law as a legal system which operates at least to a large extent similarly to national legal systems, this by and large effective application of EU law by national courts and other national authorities is essential. Now the question is EU law sufficiently applied to be a legal order? And my answer is, well, I cannot give you the numbers, and I don't think to the best of my knowledge that anyone can give you the numbers. But I'm pretty convinced that if you look at the actual numbers of day-to-day application of EU law in the national legal orders, then the image that you would get is very positive, right? So obviously we all focus on outright instances of disobedience, right, and non-application. So Polish Constitutional Tribunal, Federal Constitutional Court of Germany, and so on. But those are extremely important, but in the end, you know, discrete events, right? And by focusing on those, we automatically lose focus on the thousands of applications of uncontroversial EU law by all the district courts and the appellate courts in the member states. And if you were to do an empirical analysis of those instances of successful application of EU law, even though I don't know the outcome, I'm pretty sure you would get a very positive image of the overall efficacy of EU law and national legal orders.
So the reason why I asked these questions in this particular order is that I wanted to get a sense of how you approach the question of the nature of EU law, how you conceive of EU law, especially given all these different understandings of it. So on the one hand, we have national courts saying one thing, the Court of Justice saying something else. We've got academics trying to come up with kind of pluralist theories, which kind of center on how kind of judicial dialogue and compromise and how ultimately EU law, kind of the clashes and between legal orders should be explained through these compromises and concessions that courts make. And so given this background, I think one of the largest issues that the EU legal order is facing is this chaos, or this perceived chaos, this turmoil that is caused by these misunderstandings, or by this misunderstanding on the validity or over the validity of EU law. And so given your understanding on efficacy and your understanding of, as we've discussed, these competing rules of recognition or the possibility of there being different perceptions over the rule of recognition in the EU, I wanted to zone in and focus on one particular example. If we focus on the Polish Constitutional Tribunal's decision, whereby it found itself to be capable of essentially reviewing EU law, it said that these certain treaty provisions, articles, I believe 1, 4, 3, 19, and I think Article 2 as well, TEU, won't be binding in Poland insofar as they undermine Poland's democracy and sovereignty. And given what you've just said about there not needing to be efficacy in every single instance, given the fact that there may be these different understandings of what the actual rule of recognition of the EU is, as opposed to, you know, the way that different member states view it, and also your adoption, I guess, of Raz and his your understanding of the law as kind of requiring the comprehensiveness, supremacy, and openness characteristics as per Raz. I don't know if that's something you still subscribe to, but that's how you explained EU law in the 2018 piece. So essentially, in short, given the way that you've approached EU law from a philosophical, legal, theoretical perspective until now, do you believe that these instances where member states reject, refuse to comply with EU law, would you classify them as challenges or as threats or as problems for the EU legal order? Would you classify them as challenges or threats to its existence, to its functioning? How would you, if you were on the spot, which you are now, how would you try to make sense of them? Because we're told every single time that when a member state court refuses to comply with an EU with an EU legal norm, that there's a challenge, that there's a problem, that there's a threat of EU legal disintegration, to quote Laurent Pech, that the EU is at risk of crumbling. I mean, you can just Google this headline upon a headline will come up. And we see this similar claims, also similarly vague claims, in academic literature. So what I want to ask you is, given your research on the topic, would you classify these instances as challenging, as threats, as serious instances which could cause a problem for EU law, or not?
So I would have two answers. One is a, let's say, theoretical answer, and then a more practical answer. So my views about this particular problem, I think, are much better understood than by reading my own articles, by looking at one particular critique of my article, which will appear very soon in a special issue that I'm co-editing with my colleague Ramses Wessel. And the critique is an article by Pavlos Eleftheriadis, who has written a wonderful book, A Union of Peoples, a couple of years ago. And in his contribution, he spends a couple of pages trying to show why whatever I've been writing is absolute nonsense. And I found those pages to be very enlightening, not because I think that I'm writing nonsense, but because I think it points brilliantly at some interesting weaknesses or problems to the Razian and Hartian view of law. So basically, Eleftheriadis writes that my conception of the EU legal system, which he calls social monism, is defective because if the Polish Constitutional Tribunal or any other constitutional court tries to ignore its obligations under EU law, tries to set aside judgments of the ECJ and so on, it is basically breaking away from the EU legal order. And since, in the end, the existence of legal orders is a matter of social fact, and Eleftheriadis argues that my conclusion must be that by disobeying the CJU and its EU obligations, Poland, for instance, is basically redrawing the borderlines of legal orders. And he says that cannot be the case, because what we should say is that Poland is violating its EU law obligations. It's not the case that, they are wrong from an EU law perspective, but they're right from a Polish law perspective. They're simply objectively breaking EU law. And so the more EU law they are breaking, the more effective they will become in redrawing these borders of legal orders. And so, according to Lindebaum, if we follow his theory, we have nothing to say to the Polish Constitutional Tribunal. Now, I would agree with that assessment, and I would say, yes, that's true, and that's very unfortunate, but in the end, it's a fact of life that whenever a court or a certain political community manages to break the law sufficiently consistently and without being punished in a meaningful or corrected in a meaningful manner, they are redrawing the borderlines of legal order. In this case, Hart was right when he writes something like, in legal theory, nothing succeeds like success, right? Eleftheriadis argues that this is a reason not to commit to, let's say, the Razian view on EU law. And I would say this is a very unfortunate conclusion, but nevertheless, this is the reality of life. an example from history that you could compare this to, although this is a very different context and much more dramatic, is the secession from the southern states, from the United States, at the evening of the Civil War. So several states seceded from the Union in 1861. Of course, Civil War broke out, they lost, and the Union was restored. A couple of years later, the Supreme Court was asked whether it was legal for a state to secede, and it answered in the negative, it's not legal. But of course, had the South won the Civil War, the Supreme Court would not have rendered that judgment, right? So in this case, you know, if you, whatever the content of legal obligations are, if you successfully disobey them in a sufficiently durable and consistent manner, you will have redrawn the borders of legal orders, no matter how illegal that has been. Now, if you look at the current situation, of course, everyone should write that this is a serious violation of EU law. We cannot say that this is just a matter of perspectivism, that it's right from an EU law perspective and wrong from an EU law perspective and right from a Polish law perspective. I think that the challenges to EU law right now, and here I come to, let's say, the practical part of my answer, are much less severe than they are sometimes portrayed. What I mean by that is that K321 probably, in my personal opinion, is the best thing that could have happened to the autonomy and effectiveness of EU law as an autonomous legal order. What I mean by that is that after the PSPP judgment of the Bundesverfassungsgericht, lots of scholars as well as politicians and policymakers were very much concerned because this was a serious judgment by one of the most important constitutional courts in the European Union, with a very thorough reasoning with which many would disagree, but nevertheless you had to take it seriously. Then if you compare that to the Polish Constitutional Tribunal's judgments, the image is very different, right? So it's absolutely clear after that judgment that this is not the way to go within the European Union, right? And so after that judgment, I think all of the other member states have realized, and when I say member states, I mean the politicians, the judges, the academics, that all of these theoretical adventures into the ultimate say, etc., are very nice from a theoretical perspective, but practically speaking, this is unworkable. And so in this sense, I think in the long run, the effectiveness of EU law and its autonomy are probably in a better shape than before the Polish Constitutional Tribunal's judgment.
All right, thank you very much. We're slowly running out of time. So while I do have more questions, I think we'll start to wrap up. So so far we've had a little chat about the nature of EU law, its conditions, your way of approaching its existence, some discussion over the kind of efficacy as a condition of e-law's validity, and now we've discussed the challenges. So to wrap up, I guess, given the research that you've done until now, the way that you draft your publications is very open. So at the end of each publication, you flag up a series of potential issues and subjects that your readers can take up and continue exploring themselves. So as regards EU law, the study of EU law, research concerning the nature of EU law, what would you like readers to take from your publications and explore? What would you like, essentially, what would you like to see your research be, kind of what use would you like your research to be put to?
Yeah, so thanks a lot for saying that. I try to write my publications in a, let's say, a style that you don't see very often in the EU law journals probably, but you see it a lot in legal theory journals. So I'm really quite a fan of this open attitude where, you know, many questions and many answers cannot be discussed in the limited scope that you have within a paper. Also, there are many things that I'm quite uncertain about, and I don't want to claim that I know things that I do not, or that I am more, let's say, convinced of my arguments than I in reality am. So it's for me a natural way of writing that I find in lots of jurisprudential publications, and I think is very productive, because not only is it more candid and more honest to simply say, look, this is something I take for granted, I cannot defend this proposition here, maybe I'm wrong, but this is my starting point, as well as mentioning several things that cannot be discussed here, but might be picked up either by others and perhaps by myself in future publications. So it's a way of writing that I simply am comfortable with, and I'm happy that you sort of identified it as such. What I like to take others from my publications on the EU law is probably simply the idea that it makes sense to think about EU law and questions of EU constitutional law from a jurisprudential perspective. So my articles are very limited in scope, right? There's just one or two legal philosophers usually in each of them. There's ample questions that I cannot discuss, ample perspectives that I'm not familiar with, and that I don't have either the expertise or the time for to discuss them properly. But what I hope is that by perhaps reading some of my publications, people could be motivated to take up this sort of strand in EU constitutional law that relies more heavily on the insights of jurisprudence than what is, I think, mainstream or what is usually done. So if I can sort of motivate some people to look into legal theory and perhaps see if it can be of any help to constitutional questions of EU law, then I think that would be the best outcome for me.
All right, there you go, everyone, you've heard it here. To resolve issues concerning EU law, you just have to delve into jurisprudence, and you can start with the works of Justin Lindebo. So, Justin, thank you very much for being here with us. Thank you very much for the interview.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was it for episode 4 of Integration Through Pod. This episode was recorded in Villa Salviati, home to the EUI Law Department and the Historical Archives of the EU. The episodes are recorded at the Radio Cavolo studio, the EUI's very own researcher radio. We will put a link in the description so you can check out some of their program yourself. Thank you for listening. Give us a follow on your favorite podcast platform, and stay tuned for the next episode of Integration Through Pod.